This episode of Design by Architectural Record is sponsored by Vitro Architectural Glass. Cities and building codes are taking action against bird collision with glass. To help protect birds and help buildings meet new targets, Walker Glass and Vitro Architectural Glass team up to create Avi ProTech E Glass. With bird-friendly patterns and solar band low E coatings, Avi ProTech E Glass helps architects secure lead points for bird deterrence, energy efficiency, and more. Learn more at vitroglazing.com/birds.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Designed, a podcast by Architectural Record. We appreciate you listening, and once finished, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast, rate us, and leave a comment. If you'd like to learn more about Designed and see all the other great content that Architectural Record has to offer, please visit architecturalrecord.com for more information. Enjoy the show and have a wonderful day.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Designed by Architectural Record. I'm your host, Aaron Prinz. Again, I'm going to start this episode the same way I start every single episode, by saying thank you to all of you out there for listening to the podcast and sharing it with your friends, and for the reviews on the iTunes review section. That, again, the easiest way for us to get the podcast out to more people is just you going on there and letting us know what you think of the podcast. Be sure to check out architecturalrecord.com and follow the podcast on Instagram at designed.podcast for everything we have coming up, and hope to connect with you there. This week's episode, we have John Patkow of Patkow Architects in Vancouver, British Columbia. And I've been waiting for this podcast a long time. As I detail in the beginning, he was one of the first architects I studied when I went to architecture school. So really exciting, really great guy. I think it's an interesting approach they have to architecture, and really we go into this deep discussion about the importance of the plan to him, which I think is sometimes over or understated. I found it a really interesting concept. So without further ado, I don't want to delay this too long. So sit back, relax, enjoy. Here we go with John Patkow. So I don't know if you know this or not, but this relationship between Aaron Prinz and Patkow Architects, we go back actually about a decade. And I have to say that I had struggled through school. Like, I had struggled through school, dropped out multiple times with a number of different colleges. And then I finally went back to architecture school, and I had a professor at Portland State University, Mark Kogut, who we had to do a case study house. It was like architecture 101, where we had to do all the drawings, build a model, do all of this stuff. And there were two moments that semester where I was like, I don't know if I could do this. One was trying to read Kenneth Frampton's Critical Regionalism, because I read it like seven times, and I was like, maybe I just can't read. I don't know. I don't know what he's talking about. And the second one was having to cut 57 skylights as I built the linear house model, or 1,200, or however many are in that project. I had them all glued on, and he said, I really feel like it'd be important if you just cut them all out. And so I sat there for 7.5 hours doing that. So my first question is, why does linear house need so many skylights? And first of all, can you take us through kind of this connection? What I discovered is, you know, linear house, for those of you who don't know, it's an extremely long house. I think it's 300 feet or something close to that. It's nestled between the one strip of usable land without having to cut down trees. There's this nice view. But through that, I did, you know, the research is this connection to nature and architecture, and how does all of that come together? So it's a very long-winded backstory. So I've been waiting for this interview for a very long time. But can you just take us through that sort of that question, if you could?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. I need to describe the design a little bit before I get to the skylights. The house, as you said, is about 300 feet long, 16 feet wide. So that's why it's the linear house. And it's that proportion because of the trees on the site, as you say. On the south side, or on the, I guess it's the more western side of the house, there is a row of Douglas fir trees, which are very big monumental trees. And that row, I'm sure historically, came about as a fence line or a property line between adjacent plots of farming. And this property was still zoned as farm, was a hayfield. So that existing row of native firs was a very, very powerful element within the site. And on the other side of this narrow gap was an orchard of European and Asian fruit trees. So we had a natural landscape on one side and a cultural landscape on the other side, and the house was this stretched out thing that occupied the space between them. And so we started to build on that distinction between the natural and the cultural. And we actually had to reinforce the, or we didn't have to, but we reinforced the fruit trees, the orchard, in order to make it a more coherent form and more legible, and the distinction between the two sides clearer. But the whole notion was that this house was in this very elongated form as a response and a respect for the existing natural context. As part of that, we wanted to develop the experience within the house. Not only is it extremely elongated in its plan, where rooms are simply adjacent to one another and you walk through one room to get to the next, we wanted to reinforce the interior experience in a way that made a stronger allusion to the surrounding context of nature, keeping in mind that we had things such as an 80-foot wide operable glass wall, which was completely removed in the summertime because the climate is very, very benign, a very temperate climate. And so all of the window openings are actually retractable. So you can turn the house into simply a pavilion in the summertime. But in addition to that, we wanted to go one step further. And we developed the notion that the interior of the house would be made of translucent plastic. And so if you look at the images, you may say, oh, that's just a white drywall house. In reality, it's a white translucent plastic interior.
It kind of creates this effect that just people might know, you know, Stephen Hall has built his entire career off of this sort of translucent light coming through. So it's that sort of effect, but it's in a residential house.
Exactly. But there's more to it than simply that, because the notion was that we would put these skylights on the roof and they don't go into the interior. They go into the roof assembly. So only four of the skylights actually penetrate the roof assembly and are venting. The interior, the remaining of those 40-some skylights simply bring light into the roof assembly, which allows the skylights to illuminate the translucent plastic interior. And when you look at the image of that house and you look at the interior, the light quality of the interior, the light quality on the interior plastic ceilings and walls, and you look outside through the long operable wall, at the dappled light underneath the fir trees, they are very, very similar in their character. And so the notion is that these skylights are actually bringing the dappled light of the four forest into the interior of the house, rather than simple light and shade. So that's the backstory of all those skylights, which actually do not enter into the interior in a spatial way, only through light.
Well, I want to, you know, there's a couple things I want to talk about here, and we'll go into residential design in a little bit, but light is a reoccurring theme throughout your projects. You know, where does that come from? And when you're designing a project, like, what is the importance of light in how you're actually thinking about it? Because what I think is really interesting is you have a lot of these projects where, you know, you're talking about not penetrating fully through the roof assembly, but there's other projects where you've created kind of a crevasse or like a cavernous sort of area with just a stream of light across the top. And that's the driving force behind the design is the light. What is it about that that really is this interest in light, and how does it work its way into your projects?
Well, I'm going to give you some backstory there too, because it's actually complicated. I grew up, and Patricia, my partner, grew up in Winnipeg, which is a prairie environment characterized by big blue skies and intense light with very high contrast light and shade. So when I was an architecture student at the University of Manitoba, I learned to draw shadows as black. I learned to draw the absolute high contrast between where the sun is having an impact and where the shadow is having an impact. And that's what I understood light to be about. After I graduated, I moved out east to Toronto and was working for a German architect who had a very successful practice in Toronto. And I started drawing shadows like that. And he was taken aback. He said, shadows aren't black. Shadows are gray. And if you think back to Mies van der Rohe and his preference for cloudy skies in photographing his buildings, which come from his German background, the whole notion of the Northern European overcast light condition, where there's a very sort of luminous light, but not a high definition light, the way I grew up with on the prairies. Well, when we moved to British Columbia, we now entered into a very different kind of environment, a marine environment. So even on the sunniest days, there is enough water vapor in the air that we don't get those intense, hard blue skies and that intense light. It's all softened by the moisture in the air. And also we have much of the year is overcast. And so we had to change our view about light in this transposition from upbringing in a very, very bright, sunny place to a place which is very, again, moderate in its condition and often overcast. And so the first house we built here was a house for ourselves, and we made one third of the roof glass simply to let the ambient light enter the house and fill it with this luminosity. Because we'd observed that most of the houses here in British Columbia have the lights on in the daytime, simply because not enough brightness in the atmosphere. That first experience and our response to it made us very aware of light. The fact that we had experienced extremely different kinds of environmental light made us hypersensitive to the whole question of light. And as a consequence, every project that we've done has been tuned to light. And if the project is on the West Coast here, it's one kind of light consideration. But if we're working out east or in the United States, we treat light differently, always in terms of what we understand the local light condition to be. And so it's true that light is a driving force of our design, and our attitude toward light is changes depending upon where we are.
And I want to jump back into the first part of this question, is because I used to work at a kind of a corporate civic firm, and now I'm at a small boutique residential mm-hmm. firm, and I find, MF Architecture, Matt Ficus Architects, but I find it so much more rewarding in the residential world. You see like a client's reaction that is like they actually have an investment in it that's greater than money, that I find yes. so rewarding. So, but I think architecture, it's a really hard thing, because I go into stereotypes and what people talk about. And when people say, look at that architecture, they're not really talking about a house in general. So, and there's a lot of spec houses, there's a lot of bad houses out there. But mm-hmm. What about residential architecture is it that draws you to it? And what about residential architecture is a defining factor from this is a nice residential design to this is, a spec house that works, that's not quite architecture, as capital A people would say. Mm-hmm.
Well, our practice is, I would say, two-thirds cultural buildings, libraries, art galleries, things of that nature, and a third private houses. We haven't actually done that many private houses. We've got a number of them on the go right now, which is very unusual for us. But up till now, we've only maybe completed a dozen houses over a very long period of practice. And you're quite right. There are some distinguishing characteristics between house clients and clients for institutional buildings or corporate buildings or spec buildings. The most satisfying one characteristic is that these houses are extremely meaningful to the clients. They love them. They care for them. They come to you because they feel that you can do something for them that will improve their lives. They really view the process as a process that is engaging and is meaningful to them and is something that they're highly invested in. That is tremendous, because you then are working with an engaged decision maker who is thinking about the long-term benefits that whatever decision is required will bring.
And not just it's not just the, well, what's this going to cost me and what's going to be the ROI?
Exactly. Blah, 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 blah. In fact, I would say that virtually all of our clients have been quite clear that they were not looking at this house as a real estate investment, as something for resale. They weren't making decisions based on what they thought the market would want at some future time when they wanted to sell it. They were making their decisions really on the basis of what was important to them, what would make their lives better, and whether or not that made sense from a generic real estate point of view was immaterial. And as a consequence, you get houses that have character, houses that speak of a certain passion and a way of life, as opposed to generality, which assumes that there will be an unknown occupant at some point in the future. And I think that all of those clients have benefited in real estate terms because of that attitude, because they've actually been able to get a house that has character, that maybe doesn't appeal to everybody, but is much more appealing to a portion of the future market. And so it's a win-win situation.
Well, I also have to say, though, you know, just to play devil's advocate, you know, you look at the houses you've done and they're not cheap. And I'm sure they're not, the fee is probably not cheap to design them as well. But then,
absolutely true.
Being you look at the world now and every city is going through a very similar situation. I think Vancouver is not separated from that, where there is people that are in great need of housing. So, you know, architects, they always talk as if they have the solution to all these answers, but how does that all that fit into the practice, or does it fit into the practice at all? Does it not? We can cut this question out. I think it's a weird, architecture is one of those things that you have to be socially aware as you're just trying to make a living. So I'm just curious, you know, looking at these houses, if.
Well, there certainly is an issue there. And you're quite right. The houses that we design are not accessible to the majority of people. And that's an issue that I think about. I mean, I think that in many ways, our houses are more self-indulgent, if I can use that term, than our libraries, for example, or our art museums, especially the libraries. And we do community centers as well. Those projects are very much for everybody. And the wonderful thing about a community center or a library is that it is the most public and democratic of institutions. And we love doing them for that reason. And we feel that the skills that we have as architects probably have the most general applicability and the most benefit to society in those projects. The houses are almost more of a research, fuel our ability to do other projects. We've always used the houses as a place to learn. To do that, we've generally had the good fortune of very sophisticated clients who have enough money to do something more than the basics. And that characteristic has become exaggerated over time. The first houses we were doing were for people like retired university professors or people who very aware, very well educated, but didn't have a lot of money. And they were done, not to say that they were cheap houses, but they were done for moderate cost using conventional technologies. As the world has evolved and as Vancouver has evolved, for example, where Vancouver is one of the most expensive cities in North America, if not the world, what has happened is we have, I would say, frozen ourselves out of the house design market by and large. We're only doing now houses for people who are very well off. And that's a shame. It's a real shame. I think that we've lost something in that, gained something because we have the ability to use the houses as experiments, as vehicles to grow as architects. And we are paying back, I would say, when we're doing projects like the libraries and the community centers, which are for everybody. And those skills which we tune doing the houses are then applied to projects which are available to everyone. And so I think that's my rationale anyway for that social equation.
Well, I think it's also, you know, if you look at your work, I like to say, like, you were using wood in a way, like, before it was cool. Like, now I think you look at all these firms and they're like, well, how tall can we make a tower out of wood? And I feel like you have used details in wood for a long time. But I think there's also something about, you're talking about, you know, the residential scale. And I want to talk about, like, the Winnipeg skating shelters as well, because it's just such a small scale. When you're going from a residential unit, and we'll use like Zumthor, for example, where he's known for these like intricate details, and you can look at, you know, this one detail up in the ceiling and think, wow, look how that wood is joined. And it's just amazing. But those type of firms, when you try to apply that in a scale, King Akuma is a great example. Mm-hmm. When you try to apply that to an Olympic stadium, it's kind of irrelevant how this joinery, because one, it's just about making sure that thing doesn't collapse and kill a bunch of people. So
well, King Akuma is doing a Olympic stadium in Tokyo. So yeah. I'm curious to see.
So that's what I'm saying. So how does this, how when you're working with these sort of materials, high design, high detail level, how does that apply when you're applying it to these larger scale projects?
Yeah, that's a good question. Definitely you have to learn the difference. You have to, and the builders are different too. I mean, one of the great things about the houses is the builders are craftsmen. They're not construction managers who are organizing this huge cast of subcontractors. They're craftsmen, and they're actually the guys who are doing the work, and they have the skills to actually execute very sophisticated details. When you're doing large public buildings, that's a different game altogether. You have to be working with much more generic details, with much more generic building systems, and you have to find the architectural action somewhere else. But the scale of the project affords that. And so I think that they are fundamentally different. Our houses are jewels. The large projects are, let's put it this way, occasionally jewel-like, but they're they're never jewels.
Just so we know, this is going to be on record. There will be people. Okay. So I guess just to follow up with that, but I mentioned earlier the Winnipeg skating shelters. Mm-hmm. And what I find so interesting about that is that it is one of those moments of high detail where it's, you know, it's one general move. And you would look at something like that and say, like, that can't take that long to design. You explore these sort of typologies really well. You're not one firm that is just interested in civic or interested in housing. There seems to be a research element to your firm. Can you kind of take us through that? What does that add to your firm? And just where do you see that going and the benefit in general?
Well, there is a very active research dimension to our practice. We are constantly, I would say a third of my time on research rather than on the projects. Skating shelters was one of the earliest ones in that. And they often are at a small scale. The skating shelters actually was a very interesting experience because it was designed at full size in our workshop. It wasn't designed and then built. We actually were working with the material at full size, making forms, finding forms that worked, finding failures, figuring out how to resolve the failures. All that was done in the shop, actually making things. And so the design process, yes, it wasn't all that long, but it was challenging because of the fact that we were actually making the thing as we designed it. When we had finished making one that was successful, we took it apart and measured all the pieces and made drawings based on the pieces. And then those drawings were shipped to Winnipeg, where six more of these things were made. So it was almost more like tailoring than like architecture, where you figure out something and then somebody goes and does it. We actually cut and joined and fit all the pieces together as you would a shirt being custom made for somebody. And then we took it apart and we turned all the pieces into the design drawings. And that was very, in some ways, radical change of method for us. And after that, we did quite a number of projects using that technique and taking the lessons that we learned in terms of the material behavior that allowed us to work in a variety of materials. We did similar experiments in sheet steel, fabric, all kinds of things. In fact, it's we did a little book called Material Operations, which document a number of those projects, which ended in a large-scale temple for a yoga ashram in the interior of BC, which is a very high-performance building envelope, very technical, triple glazing, the whole thing, but it looks not unlike the skating shelters. And so we worked through, I would say, maybe a dozen or more projects to get from something we would build in our shop to a full-scale architectural project that took all those lessons. And that we continue to do that in a variety of ways. We're now designing furniture, taking a lot of the lessons that we learned from those research projects to inform the way the furniture is made. So we're working at small scale and we're working at very large scale as well.
Well, one thing, talking about materiality in wood and just kind of taking stuff apart, putting it back together, I have to bring up one project because I find it extremely interesting. So the Daegu Gosen Public Library, I find it really interesting because, I mean, we started this conversation talking about Linear House, which is essentially a rectangle that's kind of floating in the air with this heavy roof structure. But it's very linear, obviously. but it's, you know, right angles, very similar. But this project, I find it's the merger of parametric design with wood, which I find wood, that's one of the limiting factors of building with it. If you look at all these high rises that we talked about earlier, they're very much just beam on beam until you get to a certain height. And it kind of takes out this sort of design element from it. Yep. So this project in particular, I want you to, if you can, just kind of elaborate on that and materiality and how it all goes together, what the design process is like and how that all just fits.
Okay, well, you know, there is a backstory to that as well. I was teaching for a number of terms at Yale University, and there are a tremendous load of people that come through there who are extremely talented and smart and digitally savvy. I'm an old guy. I'm not digitally savvy at all. I still draw with a paper and pencil. And so I was looking at all of the amazing things that were being developed using parametric computer programs. And I kept asking the question, how do you build that? What is it made of? And I kept getting the answer, well, we don't know what that is. We don't know what it is. That somebody will figure that out in the future. And I thought, boy, if you're an architect and you don't even know what your building is made of, what is it really architecture?
Millennials.
When we started doing these research projects, starting with the skating shelters, I began to try and understand how to make these evocative curvilinear forms using parametric techniques, but using lumber. And so the penny that dropped was the notion that a ruled surface can be generated using wood members, straight wood members, 2x4s all the way up to glulams to whatever, to CLT. All of that sort of conventional wood material can be, if you use a ruled surface design, you can convert those elements into very beautiful, fluid, flowing forms. In fact, the first one that I did was a project called Rift, which was a theoretical project for a retaining wall, where we simply used 2x6s that were slightly out of alignment with one another to create these curvilinear form that we then shotcrete the one side to create the retaining wall. And it occurred to me, well, not only was the shotcrete an interesting structure, but the wood itself could have been a structure. And so that's the genesis of the Daegu library. The idea there is simply taking heavy timber elements. It's actually a very rational structure in the sense that we used 14 foot long 4x16 members that were joined in a reciprocal structure so that they were attached to their adjacent members. And each one was in a slightly different plane so that they, in aggregate, formed these very beautiful curving vaulted shapes. So not only was it beautifully curved form, it was a very efficient vaulted form, and it was made out of heavy timber. And so that was, again, a big learning exercise. And that led to the temple that I was referring to that's in southeastern British Columbia, which is made of LVLs and plywood diaphragm. And we get these, again, really lovely curvilinear and billowing forms. But all the material is either plywood or straight LVL. There's one or two glue lamps that sort of start the thing off. Beyond that, it's all straight material, which doesn't look straight at all. It all looks like it's this beautiful billowing form.
Well, you talked about the students at Yale, you know, and you saw that as a way to implement into kind of a standard building technique that you've used, or materials that you're familiar with, at least.
Yep.
But when there's colleges all over the country that this is becoming the standard of design, what do you think the impact is going to be on the profession, and just what does that look like to you?
Well, there is already a huge impact, obviously. Parametric design has some very powerful aspects, and we certainly take advantage of that in our practice. I think that inevitably the skills, the digital skills that students gain learning these programs are highly valuable and have a place in practice. Clearly, most buildings can't take advantage of a lot of that technique because of the constraints of budget and technology. But I do think that it is a force for growth. I think architecture has the potential to become more evocative, more expressive because of those tools. But they have to be mastered in the same way that the building envelope has to be mastered. And planning has to be mastered. One of the things that seems to have really fallen away in terms of architectural education and architectural skill is plans. You know, buildings don't have the beautiful plan. Le Corbusier said the plan is the generator. It's where everything comes from. But that's not true any longer. It's the parametric form that's apparently the generator. I think that that's a loss, and I think that we will have to recover those planning skills and the spatial skills. I mean, a lot of the tangible results of parametric modeling are in terms of massing and form, maybe less so space, because space is a more subtle and sophisticated thing to perceive, but it has tremendous potential to create rich spaces. And so I think all things in their time, and certainly I'm completely enthusiastic to use every one of these new tools, and we do in the office, but we still have a big wood shop, and we still build models, and we still do mock-ups, and we still have a very strong fabrication dimension to our practice.
Do you think this lack of the plan, as you say, or the lack of emphasis on the plan, do you think that's directly related to the technology, and that you can grab a really sexy rendering pretty quickly nowadays? And so it's all about that Instagram, that flashy image that's going to get the likes and get the people going? Or what do you think is the reason behind that?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, there are lots of people in our office who are skilled at Rhino, who are skilled at SketchUp, who are skilled at Revit, who are skilled at all of these interests and are parametric modelers. And what I find is that by and large, when we're working in 3D, which all of our projects are developed in 3D, I still say I need to see a good section and a good plan to understand really what we're doing. Many of the people who come here, the younger people who come here, have wonderful modeling skills, but really don't think about 2D drawings. And to me, I still find that the 2D drawing is very revealing. It's an analytic tool which allows you to really see what you're doing, whereas perspective can fool you. And so the loss of 2D drawing, I think, has some negative impact.
But I mean, it can fool you in what way? Because I feel like there's things about architecture. I have a lot of things that really bug me about architecture. But one is, you know, looking at like a plan. Is it Libeskind? There's something where if you look at the plan and you travel along that axis for like 7 miles,
yes,
you hit the site of the war that influenced the museum that's being built, and it's all BS. Like, no one is ever. The point is that I just feel like there's all this stuff that we come up with of like, this is the, and no one cares. No one realizes it. And it's all to sell the project.
Right.
So how does this, what I'm getting back to is, how does this understanding of the plan, because when you say like, well, perspective can fool you, we see in perspective. So
we do, and we inhabit buildings in three dimensions. That's all true. But at the same time, there's a reductive quality which a 2D drawing has, which edits out a lot of issues and allows you to focus on certain issues. And so, and I certainly agree with you that obscure references that are somehow tied to axes that nobody experiences in a plan is questionable. But the way people live is documented by a plan. The relationship between spaces and the relationship between elements of the project are very simply represented in a plan, similarly in a section. And it's that reduced complexity which allows you to focus on certain characteristics of the project, which 2D drawings give you, which I personally find very helpful. But that's my background, right? I mean, I certainly was trained as an architect before 3D.
I think it's a weird catch 22 in a way, because you're talking about a reduction of complexity, but the technology is amping up the complexity of projects and the scale and the budgets of everything, and everyone wants a piece that is, you know, the jewel box of the city, as it may be. So I feel like it kind of fights each other in a certain way.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. One of the very early houses that we did was a very simple house that was actually built by the owners themselves. One person did the construction documents in 6 weeks. Now, when we have Revit, even if it's a house, to do anything in 6 weeks is impossible. We're talking months. The complexity of the program and the power of the program is a great thing, but sometimes it's more power than you need. It's, you know, just being able to make a pencil on paper 2D drawing is sometimes all it takes if you have a 3D mind, if you can think about what it is that you're documenting in 2D in 3D.
Or is it that you can adjust everything in Revit in 10 seconds and that person was like, I'm not redrawing this whole plan. This is how it's getting built.
Well,
is it one of those things?
Yeah. Absolutely. But
I'm kidding with that, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. I do know what you're saying. there are virtues to the old ways.
Yeah. You know, I always think that we're kind of on this trend of parametric design right now. And, you know, architecture goes through trends. There's been modernism, postmodernism. Is there anything happening right now in the world of architecture that you say, man, I wish there was more of that? And on the flip side of that, is there anything where you're like, all right, I think it's time to move on from this?
Well, it's easier to, I guess it's easier to see what you don't like. I think a lot of the things that I don't like are projects that are one-liners, that are gimmick projects, that that are persuasive, but are actually hard to live with over the long term. That one powerful idea can sometimes be a reductive force. Sometimes projects that don't have that immediate sort of "I get it" quality are more subtle and sophisticated and stand up better over time. So what I call the sort of the one-liner, the gimmick project, is something that I wish we had less of. And it's certainly Instagrammable. It's certainly tailored to, you know, being always in the news by having these quickly consumed, clever projects, as opposed to ones that you actually have to experience in real spatial terms before you can really appreciate them. So that's my big gripe.
You know what I think? I think that is I think that there is this notion of that those are people that do not have a unique voice, and they're seeing things and they're trying to recreate what is popular at that moment, versus I think You can look at any of the major architects. We'll count yourself, we'll count Kengo Kuma, Morphosis, Zaha. It doesn't matter. There is a clear identity to the person, to the firm, to the designer, that the work is just an original. You can tell it's an original thought. And I think what you're alluding to are people that are seeing that, liking that, but that is not their sincere personality. That
makes maybe sense. So. Maybe so. I do think, though, that it's an exciting time to be an architect because all the empowering technologies that we have available to us, the digital technologies, are phenomenal. Of course, the challenge for most architects is finding opportunities to use them, because the world we live in is a very tough grind. I mean, it's people don't spend millions of extra dollars on buildings every day. And so you have a lot of constraints and you have a lot of responsibilities. I mean, it's interesting to me. When I first went to Japan, I was shocked at some of the things that I saw, and especially in houses. And I just saw an article, which is really interesting, where in Japan, houses are amortized over a 20-year period, and they're not expected to last. They're viewed as consumables. And so their whole notion of risk and responsibility is different than ours, because they don't live in a litigious society. They don't get a call from a lawyer when their building fails. It's a different cultural sort of paradigm. And certainly the one that we live under in North America is you have to be on your toes and you can't make mistakes, because if you do, it's going to hurt you.
And then there is one aspect to your firm that I want to touch on. And, you know, COVID, we've all been at home for a year. My wife and I are discovering that working in one office is not our style. But you and Patricia have founded this firm 40 years ago, and she's on sabbatical. I wish she could join us. Hopefully we can catch up with her in the future. But this relationship, the husband and wife relationship, it's not an uncommon thing in architecture. But how does that function and contribute to the culture of your firm?
Oh, it's fundamental to the culture of our firm, for sure. I mean, we have other people who are leaders in the firm now and who contribute enormously. And we've got a wonderful team. But Pat and I were the founders, and we established in some ways the identity of the firm and what we care about. And that is came about as a interesting dynamic, because we don't agree on a lot of things. And so we've had to reconcile our different points of view regarding many important issues.
And can your employees tell one day when the details are all scattered, like, oh man, something must have happened? Or no.
Well, there certainly are moments when there is high drama and there's tension. But that process of negotiation has actually been a balancing thing. It's forced us to see the other person's point of view, or maybe not accept it, but certainly to see it. And so that has been enriching. And it also has allowed us to bring others into the design process in a meaningful way. Because we were used to working with each other, bringing in another person who was a real contributor to the development of the project seemed very natural. And the idea of working in a team scenario where it's not my way or the highway, but it's everybody has ideas, and sometimes everybody's idea is the right one. And so we really do have that kind of team dynamic in the office, and it brought a lot of resources to bear on our projects that otherwise would have been lost.
What's your proudest moment in architecture?
That's a very difficult question. I've had many moments of pleasure and satisfaction. Pride, I'm not so sure about, but I don't even know if I can answer that, but I can say that in spite of the real grind that practice of architecture can be, there are moments of real satisfaction. For me, it's often when the design is really starting to come together, and also when I'm on the site and the project is sort of there, not all there, but it's enough so you can really feel it. That's often been a really satisfying moment.
What's the biggest setback you've had in your career, and how have you used it to kind of get to where you are today?
Well, the biggest setback, I would say, was when I graduated, I was sort of frustrated with the idea or my experience of practice, and I thought that I would like to have a teaching, a combined teaching and practice type of situation, which many people have. My timing was terrible. There were no openings for teachers at that time, and I was not able to sort of take that path. And so I had to make it in my practice. And I started my practice virtually out of the gate. I really didn't work for other architects beyond getting enough experience to get registered. And so that was the biggest disappointment, the fact that I couldn't have that path of combined teaching and design. It was really stuck in practice. And shortly after Pat graduated, though, she was able to get really good teaching gigs. But at that time, there was a really proactive, and I'm not saying this to denigrate her, but the really proactive search for women teachers who were desperately needed. And so many opportunities opened up for her, which didn't exist for me.
Yale. So, yeah, you know, that degree, you know, there's some, she knew some people, right? Like,
yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure.
And that's not, but I do have to say, like, starting this firm right out of the gate, you have no past clients, no real professional work. How does that work? I mean, are you like, what are those early days like? Are you just sitting around playing ping pong or?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. What I did was I worked briefly, and then I moved because of circumstances. Pat went to Yale and I couldn't go to Connecticut because there was a recession on and they wouldn't allow architects in. And so I went out west to Edmonton, Alberta, which is a oil town.
My brother was
and
there.
It was booming. It was booming. And every firm offered me a job in the city. And so I picked the firm that I felt was most congenial to me. And I worked there long enough to make a few friends in the city. And then I went out on my own. And I started by renovating a house, physically doing the carpentry work to renovate the house. And a good friend of mine knew some developers who he introduced me to. And they took a chance on me and gave me a job. And I was able to just keep going from there. I guess I was 29 years old when I opened my practice, something like that. And I hadn't much experience at all. Getting registered at that time in history wasn't as challenging as it is today. And so I really didn't have complete experience. I'd never done a set of working drawings, but I survived.
It was in Japan where it only had to last for 20 years and then it was
fine. Well, you know, it's interesting. I was lucky to get a guy who knew how to do that, and away we went.
Knowing what you know now in, you know, 40-year career, killing it all over the place, knowing what you know now, what would you say to 18-year-old John sitting in his studio that you think would help you along the way?
You know, the one thing that, one decision that I made that I wonder about was staying where I live, staying in Canada, for example, as opposed to going to Europe. At the time I graduated, North American architecture was very strong on the world stage, and it seemed like the place to be. 15 years later, the action had really moved to other places. Europe and Japan were doing much more ambitious stuff. And I think that that's largely true today. It's stayed that way. And so I think that maybe being more mobile would have been a thing to do. It didn't occur to me at the time, and I'm not sure that it wouldn't have opened more interesting doors.
Last question. What's next for you? What's next for PADCO Architects? And what do you think is next for the profession in general?
I've tried to become more proactive by not waiting for clients. And so the research projects are things I invest a lot of energy in, and that allows me to work on things that I find challenging and interesting, regardless of whether there's clients out there looking for things. We're now moving into furniture design. I've actually begun doing sculpture. And so I'm finding that what's next for me is self-initiated projects where I don't have to wait for somebody to ask me to do something. Trying to figure out how to do that and scale up in that is something that I'm thinking about, because I just feel that I have potential to be a good client for myself. So that's sort of what I'm experimenting with right now. Just in terms of the profession in general, I think it's it's a challenging time, but there are big issues. Certainly, sustainability, both environmental and social sustainability, are huge challenges that we face. Doing what you can in that area is very meaningful. There's all sorts of technological developments that are occurring, which are very interesting. I'm finding that becoming more active in building and more engaged in how things are built is also richly rewarding and freeing in some ways. And so, again, expanding what the area of interest of an architectural practice is what I think is the way to the future.
Well, John Patkow, this has been amazing. I mean, again, I've been waiting 7 years to talk to you about this and the skylights at Linear House. So thank you so much. I enjoyed it. I think my audience will as well. I hope you did. And thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you for listening to an episode of Designed, a podcast by Architectural Record. If you enjoyed this episode, we would appreciate you taking a moment to subscribe to the podcast, give us a rating, and leave us a comment. Have a wonderful day.